Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to session 6F, concurrent session 6F of the 2011 Institute of Actuaries Biennial Convention. I see we have a small but elite audience here today. I think I've seen some glimpses of the presentation we're going to see today, and I think I can promise you that you've made the right decision by coming along to this session, and I think we're in for an interesting session. To start off with, we've just come from the luncheon session, so if anyone's accidentally left their mobile telephone switched on after lunch, could you please either turn it off or switch it to silent? And also, just on another matter of administration, if everybody could grab their feedback forms ready to complete towards the end of a session, and if I could have a volunteer from somewhere near the back of the room, Rick Shaw, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, you will not be permitted to leave this room until you have handed your feedback form to Rick Shaw at the back of the room there. And Rick is normally very mild-mannered, but he can get rather aggressive with people who don't hand in their feedback forms. Ladies and gentlemen, we're very lucky to have two experienced and insightful general insurance actuaries to do our presentation for today. We have Donna Walker and Daniel Smith. Before I introduce them, just another couple of announcements. Donna and Daniel expect to present for about half an hour. Now, we do have a full hour. Our finish time is 20 minutes past three. So that is intended to leave lots of time for discussion, questions and comments. So as Daniel and Donna are presenting, if you'd start to think of those first one or two questions or observations or comments, then that will be terrific, because that will help our discussion to get underway and be very worthwhile. We do have a microphone there at the front of the floor. As you come up to make your comment or ask your question, if you could start by announcing your name and your employer, that will be very helpful, because the whole session is being recorded for posterity. Daniel and Donna are quite happy to take questions during their presentation, so if you feel the need, then just put up your hand, come and approach the microphone, and I'm sure at the next convenient short break they will call for your question. Okay, I think that is all on the administration side, so it just falls to me now to introduce our two speakers. And despite all protests from Donna Walker, the way I'm going to do it is simply to read the two bios that have been put in front of me, which I think you'll appreciate. Donna Walker. Donna is the General Manager Technical Services at CGU Insurance, part of the IAG Group. She has over 11 years' experience working in the general insurance industry and has worked in her current role since June 2008. As General Manager Technical Services, she's responsible for delivering a variety of support services for CGU. Functional support teams within her mandate include finance, actuarial, risk, reinsurance and capital, management information, portfolio management and technical capability development. Donna has held a variety of senior roles within CGU, including head actuary. Prior to this, she spent 3 years lecturing at the University of Melbourne in the Centre for Actuarial Studies and held various roles in the superannuation industry, managing client relationships and agreeing services and strategies for a portfolio of corporate clients. Donna holds a Bachelor of Science and is a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. Daniel Smith is an actuary with Taylor Fry and is currently on council. He's not a great fan of long, waffly bios. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome. First of all, we'll hear from Daniel Smith, and then about halfway through, we'll hear from Donna Walker. Please welcome Daniel Smith.
Thank you, John, and apologies to Donna, because I sent that bio through without seeing her, so it wasn't actually meant to be having a dig
at Donna. Give
it a The presentation today is obviously covering past, present and future involvement of actuaries in GI. We're we're covering the facts parts of past and present, or at least how we see them. The future bit's a bit of a debate, and so hopefully at the end of this there is some discussion around what the future might look like, and certainly challenge the views that we put forward. We came up with an alternative title for the paper, which is the meaning of GI, and for those of you who are Monty Python fans, then hopefully you'll understand where we go from here. For those who aren't, hopefully I've made it clear throughout that it's not just about Monty Python. But before we start, we would like to pay our respects, or certainly our gratitude, a range of senior actuaries throughout various insurers and consultancies provided a fair bit of information that led into this, including some aspects that you might that are commercially sensitive, and people were pretty good at, or a lot of people were pretty good at providing that. So we'd like to pay our gratitude to them, and also pay our respects. That was just because Donna and I vote for Collingwood. That wasn't anything more.
And we're both from Melbourne.
So we borrowed the structure of the paper really has borrowed heavily from the meaning of life in Monty Python. So the first part we go through is the miracle of birth. Then we look at growth and learning, how actuaries have developed. A bit of fighting each other. That's not so much about fisticuffs, but as competition. Middle age, which is where we're pretty much saying we're at now. Live organ transplants, more to do with technology and how we've developed. The autumn years, what do we look like going forward? And then finally, death. Will we die? So, GI started off with a handful of actuaries in the sort of mid-70s, so that effectively our birth. Most of those guys were in consultancies doing superannuation or life, and then moved into a bit of GI. There are a couple of people within general insurance companies, and in effect, and for some reason, this particular projector or computer doesn't work the way it's meant to. So these guys were effectively the first fish in the sea.
Morning. Morning.
So those you might have recognised a number of those faces. Hopefully you did. Most of those guys were involved in the mid to late 70s in terms of starting off GI. And yes, it wasn't an easy path, though, to break into general insurance. The general insurance companies had executives there who'd been there for 20 years and all knew the business backwards, or at least that's what they would all say. And so making ground and actually having a say was pretty hard work. So those founding GI actuaries worked pretty hard to make a name for themselves and actually get in and get some work. Probably one of the biggest assistances to actuaries actually making their name in GI was the high inflation that was going around at the time, and where the companies were relying on case estimates to set their reserves, and then a year later being found to be grossly inadequate because of very high rates of inflation, meant that the actuaries were able to come in and put reserves in that took account of that, and started to gain notoriety, particularly from the auditors, who would be able to then say, well, the reserves have been adequately assessed. With the sort of growth of actuaries in GI, we also then needed to develop a better path for actuaries, I suppose, basically those who are trained in GI to work in it, not those that have come from other areas. So there was a fair bit of development in the GI course and notes and the like. And we also, at that point in time, had quite a wide range of practices. There wasn't a standard textbook to follow, so people were making up ways of doing things or applying methods in slightly different ways. We also got to push our minds back, and some of us sitting in the audience, that's pre-being born, to days where you're doing actuarial evaluations with a calculator and a pen and paper. There weren't laptops, there weren't even the mainframe sorts of systems to what we might think of. So the methods had to be able to be applied reasonably readily. So the growth and sort of learning stage of GI actuaries was through the late 80s and the 90s. There was massive growth in numbers of actuaries involved in GI. There's also very considerable development of GI methods. And to the stage where the way methods were applied and the sorts of methods were applied became largely the same, certainly across the consultancies. That time was also where the consultancies really did develop. The PwC started up an actuarial team in the late 80s, I think, and it was Coopers and Libran then, and Trowbridge started to grow from, they founded in the late 80s and started to grow considerably, and Tillinghast was here and growing. So the consultancies probably through that time at least quadrupled in size. And as I mentioned, the GI course and textbook was developed, and the development of a textbook in GI I think was a first, and certainly meant that new actuaries or analysts coming in learnt the methods in a structured form rather than the ad hoc manner that had been the case before. One of the other aspects that really started to change practice was the development of a practice note. There was a lot of debate going around in the mid to late 80s about whether or not we should have professional standards and the like, and a practice note was developed in the late 80s which put some structure around what actuaries would do. All of this, and I suppose I've omitted to say that most of the work that was being done by actuaries at this stage was reserving. There was elements of pricing sorts of work and some aspects of work in the accident compensation schemes which looked at scheme costings and the like, but still the majority of work was in reserving. I mentioned the development of the practices in the accounting firms. Once PwC got going and well established, certainly all the other accounting firms looked to build up their own teams, and each of them now has a reasonably sizable GI practice. The accident comp schemes, accident comp was largely privately underwritten up until sort of the mid to late 80s, and then the development of various work cover schemes and motor accident schemes meant that there was a lot of work now for actuaries in advising the governments and the managers of those schemes. It's fair to say that actuaries didn't cover themselves in glory in terms of some of the estimates that came up. But having said that, we were still better placed than anybody else to have a stab in, at what these schemes' costs might look like. One of the problems, and arguably it's still a bit of a problem today, but certainly a big problem going back at that time, was that actuaries would talk in actuarial speak, and we'd talk about loss ratios and things, meaning an actuarial loss ratio, not claims paid over, or what I would deem an accounting loss ratio. And so there tended to be a bit of confusion sometimes between what the actuary was talking about and what the business was talking about. And certainly that posed a real challenge for, getting in and getting more work other than just some of the reserving. But communication is certainly something that needed to be worked on.
Simply collect his note before lunch, after you've done your scripture prep, when you've written your letter home before rest, move your own clothes onto the mirror peg, greet the visitors, and report to Mr. Bailey that you've had your chintz sewn. Now, sex.
So, yeah, it's pretty simple. Donna's now going to talk about the next couple of elements.
Okay, and you'll be pleased.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning.
And that gets me away from talking about sex, so that's all good. Okay, so fighting each other. Fighting each other is, as Daniel said at the start, it's not about actuaries actually coming to fisticuffs, although there was a little bit of difference of opinion coming out in the late 90s and the noughties. Fighting each other is more about the competition that was occurring in the GI industry at that time. So we had competition arising through lots more people working in the consulting arena. We had competition between internal actuaries within insurers and consulting firms themselves. We had competition for key roles with the approved actuaries coming through. Generally, there was a lot of activity and a lot of demand that was actually happening in the GI market. I suppose we called it the end of the collegiate approach, in that people did actually have a view and they were willing to put different views on the table. Some of those views were put quite publicly. Some of them were behind closed doors. But I guess if you think about it, GI actuaries were flexing their muscles in quite a few ways in that period. And, of course, it came off the back of the demise of HIH. HIH put insurance, or general insurance, under incredible scrutiny. There was a wholesale response from the government, and we saw the creation of, I always get this around the wrong way, the appointed actuary, which was downgraded to the approved.
No, it was approved.
Oh, still can't get it right. Yeah. So effectively, though, we had a strong governance role coming out of a regulatory regime, which, you know, is now coming up to 10 years old, standing when you think about it. That in itself was very valuable from a professional viewpoint, but also in some ways actually created a role for the actuary that in some ways could have actually restricted their role in some respects as well. You can decide whether or not that's true. I guess during that time we had some substantial growth of actuaries in GI, and these numbers are numbers that Daniel and I have put together based on what we've been able to glean together and just on some industry stats. Again, for those of you who are exact on detail, you could probably argue the toss, but I think the trend is quite significant, quite substantial. What I think is probably critical in those numbers is that the growth actually came from probably more so in insurance companies. So the growth, a lot of the growth in that period came from growth in internal actuarial resources as compared to consultants. So consultants have been growing. They still grew during that period, but there was definitely an upswing in actuarial resources in internal companies or insurance companies. That in itself brought around a change in relationships within insurers. So you had internal actuaries doing roles that were traditionally outsourced, and yet there was still outsourcing that was occurring. Consultants during that time suddenly found that they were dealing with internal actuaries rather than with management. The questions that they were being asked changed a bit. They moved a bit more towards technical. There was suddenly more challenge again in that space. There was also, I guess there's a bit of a trend in how work came in in-house to insurers, and again, you can form your own view as to whether or not you believe it's true. Pricing work internally tended to be done in insurance companies by internal staff, possibly statisticians more so than actuaries, and then actuaries have taken up that work over time. Pricing in statutory funds and perhaps sort of like more regulated environments like workers' comp might still have had consultants involved in it, but more and more that's come in-house. Reserving tended to be the domain of consultants, but again, over time, insurance companies, as they've grown their own internal capability, have actually brought that work in-house. We've also had the... let me get it right this time, appointed actuaries, as they are now known, and the external peer review. So I've had a lot of opinions in that governance space, a lot of opinions on the same issues, particularly around the reserving space. We now have, in large organisations, we have three pairs of actuarial eyes look at reserves and give an opinion. It's helpful if they're all the same opinion. It's interesting when they actually conflict, and how do we work through that. That, again, creates challenges for us as an actuarial profession. How do we have the professional conversation between actuaries versus how do we have the information from an internal versus a consulting perspective in terms of giving the right views to management? Essentially... We've had to grow a little bit in terms of thinking about those roles. As an internal actuary, do you compete with consulting actuaries, or do you try and reach alignment before you actually talk to management and present a view that might have differing of views but is actually still a consolidated front? It means we work together in slightly different ways. Also, again, going back to the fighting each other, we can compete. So internal actuaries and consultants can sometimes compete, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. So, middle age. We think we've reached middle age. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. You think middle age, you usually tend to start, things start to sag in all the wrong places, get a few wrinkles, but then the same thing, we're actually comfortable in our own skin. You can put a positive or a negative slant on it. We do want to thank the actuaries who provided details of their companies. Again, this is our view of how what the current environment looks like. So we estimate that at the moment, in our middle age status, we have about 700 plus actuaries working in GI, of which 350 are fellows and 400 are non-fellows. Don't know if that resonates with people in the audience. Again, might be a question or a comment later. We think it's a fairly reasonable estimate based on just the people we've talked to and the feedback that we've got. That has some implications, though, in terms of what that means for us as an industry. If we've got 350 fellows and 400 non-fellows, that means that the competition for the more senior roles is hotting up. How do we actually manage that whole concept of lots more senior type organisations or senior type roles and expectations of people as they come through and they qualify? What are the roles for these newer students as they come through? What are the roles for actuaries in organisation? There is only a limited number of senior roles, so where do our actuaries go? We've also taken those numbers and split them down as to where we think people are actually working. So, again, you can say spurious accuracy about whether or not it's 57% of people who work in reserving, but over half of those 700-odd actuaries in GI are still working in the reserving space. Now, their remit has probably broadened. It's not just about producing an outstanding claims provision. We have EPRs, we have FCRs, we have that. We have premium liabilities. So the scope of what actuaries have done in that reserving space has changed considerably over the last 20 or so years. But it's still bread and butter for our profession. A lot of people are working in reserving. About 25% we estimate are working in pricing. Essentially, again, mainly personal lines is utilising actuarial skills. So home motor, we had John Trowbridge at lunch talking about flood and the role actuaries obviously have to play in there is quite a predominant one. Statutory schemes, again, CTP, workers' comp are roles for actuaries, and we have people there. Probably more actuaries are moving into commercial lines, but it's a different business again, and there's obviously reinsurance as well. The rest, the rats and mice, capital. We have overarching roles in capital that perhaps didn't exist even 10 years ago, so thinking about capital management in organisation. We have some actuaries that are branching out just into general management and taking on more broader roles in organisations within GI. And we also have some more advisory, non-traditional type roles that we're picking up. So, again, interesting picture to look at and think about where our profession is at and where we're actually targeting our skills and what does that mean for the future. It's quite interesting when you talk particularly to newer actuaries coming through, how they perceive the GI industry and what's the sexy type roles. Pricing is seen as a sexy type roles, and yet our bread and butter is still sitting in the reserving space, and how will that change going forward? So, we're now a generation of accounting actuaries. A lot of our consulting resources sit in the Big Four. They're a very dominant force in terms of that space, and our work, as we said, is predominantly in that reserving space. Some questions that we asked and got some comments on are we as actuaries in GI? We were actually leading edge in those very early days, helping push organisations to where they need to be. Are we still in that space? Are we still actually in that decision-making and pushing new frontier space? Or actually are we supporting decisions from insurers? Insurers themselves have actually grown up quite considerably over the last 20, 30 years. And certainly roles that I saw actuaries doing even 10 years ago are now being filled by smart business analysts. People are doing the things actuaries were doing 10 years ago. It's now being done by people who aren't from a traditional actuarial background. We've got a comment up there around professional standards. As we have more and more actuaries working in-house, what does that mean in terms of professional standards? Consulting firms are very good at having that sign off on what we do and the advice that's given, because it is considered actuarial advice. One of the challenges that we have from an internal perspective is how do we maintain that integrity of professionalism? How do we actually make sure we adhere to those standards, and how do internal teams actually do that, given that they have a whole remit of things to do? Their work doesn't finish actually at completing the outstanding claims report. It's actually, let's check and see what went through the ledger. Let's actually talk about monthly results. It is a continuous process that has no start and end. So how do we make sure we adhere to that professional standard? How can we actually use the skills from the consulting actuarial firm to support that? We asked questions of the people who contributed to this paper about how they perceive the role of the Institute for GEI actuaries. Predominantly, we asked the more senior actuaries, and the role was described as one of a licensing type of arrangement. They give us a license to operate and within our actuarial boundaries, which again probably shows where a lot of our profession has actually come from. We talked to the more senior, more long-serving actuaries, and they have a really strong network, and you know, even the hello-hellos we had up there at the start, most people know each other who have been in the industry for a long time. What does that mean for our newer actuaries coming through? What's the support that the Institute is going to provide, and is it still there just as a licensing organisation? If it's not, how do we ensure that we have that appropriate level of support for our younger, less experienced actuaries as they come through? We asked a few questions about the small A actuary designation. What did this mean to us as a part of the profession? Did we have a view as GI actuaries? Quite interesting, I think, from an insurer perspective. Internal actuaries were a bit relaxed about it, sort of saying, look, if it's the right people for the right roles and you get the people in to do the roles, and if they've got the right skills, qualifications, big actuary, small A, doesn't make a difference. The consulting firms were a little bit more anxious about it, for want of a better word, and it comes back to that adherence to professional standards, upholding the code of conduct and the professionalism that needs to go with actuarial advice. And again, that was quite telling. If you think back to the comments we made about professional standards, about the difference between internal and external, and have the internal actuaries got the right level of focus, etc. The question we've posed at the end is, as GI actuaries have grown up, they've moved into the steady jobs within insurers rather than the risky consulting roles. Who are our trailblazers going forward? Is consulting a more risky role? Not sure, but something to pose a question to. So that's Middle Ages.
Live organ transplants.
Daniel.
So the live organ transplants is really about the developments in modelling that we've seen, and there's been massive advances in statistical pricing, DFA, optimisation, data mining, and now developments in stochastic reserving. So if you go back, I suppose you go back 10 years ago, most of those were either not heard of or just being talked about, whereas now you know, lots of that stuff is pretty much commonplace. So 1954 was the first live human liver transplant, first live organ transplant of a human in 54. Can you imagine at the time it would have been, you know, an absolute miracle, witch doctors, that sort of thing. Now live organ transplants are common practice. It's, you know, people going in for quadruple bypasses and liver transplants and all these sorts of things. It's just not unusual. I suppose it's the same with all of these sorts of methods. If we go forward another 10 years, how much of these methods are going to be absolutely commonplace? And what methods will we have that we don't currently use. Stochastic reserving's an example. There's a few organisations that are delving into it and doing little bits and pieces, but it's a pretty hard sell at the moment to get somebody to move from their deterministic model where you can look down and see all your assumptions being picked to going to a stochastic one where you're, to some extent, relying on a model to tell you what the assumptions should be. That said, in 5 years' time, I don't know, in 10 years' time, everyone will be doing stochastic reserving. It will be the way of... just the same as GLMs is the way people do their personal lines pricing. Stochastic reserving will be used for larger classes of business where you've got a heap of dough. It's not going to be used for each class where you've got a dozen claims or something small, but where you've got large amounts of data, your accident compensation type schemes or your... larger long-tail liability portfolios will certainly be using that sort of approach. What's happened is we've really had a divergence really in the sorts of actuaries that are out there. Now, we do have some people who would get called propeller heads who are extremely technical, extremely detailed in a particular area and... they've taken it beyond what we would see as the actuarial side of things, and they're really down into the extreme technical aspects of it. So we've because of this increased competition, effectively, and because of increased computer capacity and all of that sort of thing, we've now got techniques that are enabling people to be extremely specialised. It does raise the question, though, as whether or not we're getting too clever. There's no point being able to do lung transplants if we're not going to discourage smoking. So there's no point creating a massively technical model when a simple solution will fix it. So I think that the technical advancements have been good and will continue, but we should always keep in mind that we don't want to do all that stuff just for the sake of it. There's got to be a reason, there's got to be a value add. There's no point having all those machines if you don't have anything to operate on.
When I get older, losing my hair many years from now, will you still...
So as we go forward, as we move into our autumn years, there's a range of questions that we've posed and some thoughts. One of them is what will our founding GI actuaries be doing going forward, and they've paved the way in a sense for us moving into GI. Will they pave the way for us onto boards and more I suppose senior roles within the insurance industry or even outside? Martin, you going to answer that?
No.
What's going to happen with the brand of the small A actuary? I think that the purchasers of actuarial services are typically not well informed or not easily able to differentiate between different actuaries. And so as we go forward and we've got fellows and small A actuaries and whatever, I can see the waters being muddied in terms of how services get provided. Now, within, as Donna talked about, within an insurance company, it seemed pretty clear that it was going to be the person's capabilities and how they performed at their job within that company that saw how they got promoted or what they did. Within consultancies, and certainly with consultancies picking up work going forward, I think it's actually going to be a challenge to maintain differentiation or build it up. We're also arguably at risk of statutory overload. By that, I mean that we've got a number of actuaries now who are pushed very much into compliance roles. One of the difficulties in doing compliance sorts of reserving work now is that you typically get the data one day and the phone call the next saying what's the answer, and therefore very limited time to do any real analysis. Yet in theory, the reserving aspect is where you should be learning all the information about the business and how it's travelling. There's a huge amount of knowledge that should be gained from the reserving, and we're not able to do it because we're meeting the compliance schedules set by the accountants and the like, and also being arguably pushed into sort of second tier roles in that sense by reporting through the CFO, and yes, the AA still reports to the board, but in terms of getting the results done, we're now not necessarily reporting to the senior managers directly. We're also going to come under increased scrutiny for justifying the actuarial team. The numbers of actuaries and the teams within the general insurance now, particularly the big ones, is at least as big as in the major consultancies. That starts to add up to a lot of dollars at current actuarial salaries. So they're either going to be cuts in salaries or people are going to have to find better ways of justifying the use of that many people. And one of the points that Donna noted was that starting to see now a range of jobs that would have previously been undertaken by actuaries or actuarial analysts being undertaken by cheaper resources. So we are at risk going forward of being too expensive to do some of what you might term the more mundane tasks. We believe there'll be a continuation of this diversion between the technical actuary and the management actuary, the actuary who works in the business in looking at the results and the backroom person who goes and develops wonderful models. What we're at risk of, I suppose what I believe will happen is that there will be continued growth for actuaries within GI, but that will slow down, and it's a matter of how long that will continue for. And accident comp schemes is really going to be dependent on what happens nationally. It seems likely that our involvement there will be maintained unless a national scheme is developed, which would seem unlikely. And now we should move on to death. I'm sorry, I'm just rushing through here so we've got enough time for some questions at the end. But I want to do this first too.
Yes? Is it about the head? But I'm awfully sorry. Yes, I see.
I am Death.
Yes, well, the thing is, we've got some people from America for dinner tonight.
Who is it, darling?
It's a Mr. Death or something. He's come about the reaping. I don't think we need any at the moment.
Hello. We didn't leave him hanging around outside, darling. Ask him in.
I don't think he's quite the mood yet. Do, come in. Come along in. Come and have a drink. Do.
I am Death. Well, that's cast rather a gloom over the evening, hasn't it?
Can I ask you a question?
What?
How can we all have died at the same time?
The salmon mousse.
Darling, you didn't use canned salmon, did you?
I'm most dreadfully embarrassed.
Now the time has come. Follow me.
Many of the sorts of issues we talk about with the autumn years are also similar or extensions of them we're talking about here in terms of death. Are we nearing the end? Are we creating a sustainable basis for having 750 or more actuaries working in general insurance? We think the answer is no, but we don't think the future or the success in the future is going to look like it did in the past. It sort of does, sort of doesn't. We need to understand what actuaries need to do, and certainly what we need to be able to do is provide a business case for continuing to do the work. So where we're doing technical sorts of work, we need to be able to show that we can do it as well or better. If we're going to charge more, we need to be able to show we can do it better. Where we're in the business, we need to be as good or better communicators, arguably better communicators than we are now. So we need to be able to talk to the business about things that matter to them, not things that matter to us. And I think actuaries, one of the issues that's developed with consultants talking to actuaries in-house is we've now built up this great communication between actuaries and actuaries, and we've actually moved a step away from being able to communicate to the business. And there are some actuarial teams that I think are more isolated from the business now than they were basically at the time they were formed. Yep, I got that. What about the education system? And I suppose the point here is, is the education system really creating the framework for educating the actuaries that in the manner we want or need? My observation is that the university-based programs are great for the universities, but if you talk about the communication aspects and the work experience and the ability to talk to the business, is our education program attracting the right people? Medicine, a decade or more ago, went in a number of universities to interviews for people before they got in, because they worked out, and you know, we've all been to some bad doctors where you sit there and they're very clever people, but they can't tell you what's wrong with you because they can't talk. So they knew you needed to be able to talk to a doctor, and a doctor needed to be personable, and that was as much, if not more, important than the diagnosis. And have we reached the stage where we actually need to start thinking along those lines as actuaries? Compliance versus value, we've talked about that we just need to maintain that we're adding value, not just getting into a compliance role. We believe that what the way things have moved means that it's effectively the death of the jack-of-all-trades actuary. We're going to have actuaries in management who are good at managing people or dealing with business. We're going to have technical actuaries who are good at that. But if you're not good at either, you're not going to have a place. You're going to have to be one or the other. There is going to be an increased regulator focus going forward, and it's hard to know how good that is or not. Richard Fitzherbert raised a question some time ago about what's an actuarial paradigm and what is ours, and I'd encourage everyone to think about that. What is it that we are going to be able to use to sell ourselves to the business, particularly as technology has improved? Other people can do cash flows and net present values now. That's not ours to be able to do and charge exorbitant fees for. So we need to be able to understand what our paradigm is and make sure everybody else understands it too. Is there an afterlife? Just a quick add-on at the end. Arguably, yes. Lots of the GI skills that we've built up can be applied in non-insurance areas, and Adam's probably quite keen to talk to people about that. I think we should be trying to make more of the reserving role and bring it back from being compliance. We've got to stand up on our feet and argue the toss, I think, in terms of saying reserving is more important than just the number at the end of it. And finally, avoid the salmon moose.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Daniel. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pretty confident that we've had both the most musical and the most theatrical presentation that you're likely to see at this convention. We still have 10 minutes, and what I'd like to do is get five or six fairly short and sharp questions, contributions, observations, or comments. So who would like to open the discussion? Ralph.
Informal or?
Up to the microphone.
I can talk about this because I've already been on record with this statement. Ralph Blanchard, Casualty Actuarial Society. I wrote an article for the Actuarial Review in the CAAS 6 months back called The Case Against Stochastic Reserving. I've been working in a firm for my entire actuarial career, over 20 years, and I don't see a business value added for stochastic reserving in many cases. I see tremendous business value add for the actuary using their data mining tools and predictive modeling in a claim department, identifying where to focus the claim resources, where to actually analyze things. But with the reserving itself, the question is, it's the old saying of horseshoes and hand grenades, it's good enough. If being within 5% of the right answer is all management needs, and then they need to know what the major drivers are, to apply a distribution around it that's all just a guesswork because you know your mean's wrong, so now you're going to have more ways you can be wrong, I don't really see the value in the stochastic part for many lines. For excess lines, it's critical. For a straight primary, you know, first dollar, I'd rather see the resources spent on the data mining in the claim area where I think there's real value added.
Daniel, would you like 60 seconds by way of response?
60 seconds. Yeah. I don't disagree with what you said there. In terms of coming to a number, the stochastic aspect of it doesn't really help you much at all. I mean, where I see stochastic reserving as being important, I suppose a range of ways. One is what we want to do with reserving is make it more than just a number. We want to understand the business, and the stochastic modelling helps you do that. It helps you when you're looking at a number, is that an outlier or is it a trend, or, you know, exactly how do I deal with it? It gives you some assistance. It's only going to be useful for the large long tail classes of business in terms of where you're going to get real value add out of it. And it's also in terms of, well, in the Australian situation, we put on a central estimate plus a risk margin, and the way people get to that risk margin is relatively ad hoc, I believe, and whereas the stochastic process is certainly going to give you a way of getting into that.
Thanks, Daniel. Rick Shaw.
Hi. I agree with Ralph, and I actually think that the extent that we do very sophisticated reserving and other technical work in Australia is actually a reflection of the fact that we tend to be clever with our sit in the clouds being clever with ourselves. And I think the challenge to the Australian profession is in that figure. We've only got 4% of actuaries in GI are working in management. That should be our future.
Thanks, Rick. Can we get two or three more very quick contributions? That was the 5-minute bell. Martin.
Talking about the distribution of actuaries, I was interested in the numbers you had for fellows and non-fellows, and it was roughly one for one. It was 350 or 400. But the profession as a whole in Australia, I think, is about 1 to 2 or maybe 1 to 3 even. So the fellows are perhaps 1/3 of the profession. What is it about GI that makes us so different from this average, and where are the rest of the analysts working?
You know we don't know that. I don't know. What's the latest number? It's about 4,000 members and 2.5 fellows, I think.
I guess it was something like that.
Yeah, so that's catching up.
I think.
Tom, no, you go.
I think the answer is, Martin, they'll take that one on notice.
I will make a comment, though. I freely confess I don't know the answer, but I think there is something about the GI industry that a lot of younger people are attracted into it. We are growing, and there is the speed at which people qualify these days means they come into GI quite early. They qualify and they stay. So there is something about the makeup of GI that I think is a bit different to some of the other industries. Now, that is all based on intuition and no evidence whatsoever. But if I look at the makeup of the actuarial team within my team, actually, the ratio of actuaries, qualified actuaries, is pretty high, and it's because we've brought people in and they've stayed. Like, there's something that creates a longevity in GI.
Thanks, Donna. Still room for one or two quick questions, contributions, observations? Pat.
Pat Tuffle, Casualty Actuarial Society. I'm disturbed that you think death is near, because I have a much more optimistic perspective. But I do think that we can gain insight from the early years in terms of where success came and what the drivers were and what we may need to do differently as we think about the new frontier. When I think about the early years, it was all about bringing value to organizations by bringing a different perspective. And you're absolutely right. Those early pioneers were hungry for business and very attuned to listening to what the needs were and finding solutions to those needs. I think we have become somewhat complacent, and we are much more willing to look at our own navels and not as focused on what are the business needs and emerging business needs that we can address. And I think that part of the what will the afterlife look like really drives from how willing are we to become just as hungry as the early players were in finding the new frontiers where we can add value.
Thanks, Pat. Do we have another question, observation? I'll challenge perhaps some of the younger members of our audience. At one point, we were talking about whether the Institute of Actuaries of Australia is just a licensing authority, and if not, then what should the Institute be doing to support its membership, and in particular, to support its newer and younger actuaries? Do any of the under 35 members of the audience have a view on what the Institute is doing, or what the Institute could be doing, or what we could be doing better? You're a very young under 35 year old, Rick, but I don't think you're eligible for this one. We still have room for one final contribution from anyone? A question? Okay, in that case, ladies and gentlemen, I wonder if... Oh, I'm sorry, Pat. Did you have
I was really going to extend the question to how adequate is your education system to some of the young folks, and to ask what is it as they've begun their work experience that they wish they had known or learned that they didn't get from the education system.
Lena.
I thought I'd add, around the education system, it feels it's very prescriptive. So like what's been said, we need to think outside of the square and promote those types of skills. So something potentially the Institute could do to promote some of that.
Great. Thanks, Lena. Do we have still room for one final quick... Yes.
I guess I'll comment on the education thing. I came at at actuarial work from a non-actuarial background, and there does seem to be an impression amongst actuaries that if you want to know something, go find an exam and take it, and that'll teach you how to do it. And this is kind of a unique attitude that you don't really see elsewhere, and I think actuaries need to be sort of more willing to go out and find things out for themselves, even if there isn't an exam that'll tell them exactly what it is they need to know.
Thank you, Jonathan. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think that probably winds up our time. I think I heard the second bell, so the only thing that remains for us to do is to thank our two presenters for, I would say, they put a significant amount of time and effort into the presentation. Damn. So would you please join with me in thanking our two authors, Daniel Smith and Donna Walker.